And during that time, again, economic realities kind of hit me in the face. So here I am trying to face some of those realities through work in Christian ethics, writing, teaching, and studying about these some of these subjects from that perspective. In these 5 weeks, what we intend to do is face what I understand to be a glaring contradiction that is fundamental to our lives as North American citizens of relative economic privilege. And the contradiction in simple terms is this. We are called to love neighbor. That is our calling. That is the purpose for our being, to receive the love of God, to love God in return, and to love each other. It seems to me that nothing is more fundamental to the biblical messages than this. It is not only a calling, but it is a promise. We are promised, and many of our forebearers throughout history have talked about the promise of our power to live as people who love, because we love God, because God lives in us, and we are children of God. But in a stark contrast and a tragic contrast to that calling and that reason for being, we end up part of a global economy that, rather than loving neighbor, thoroughly exploits. Part of a global economy that is ripping, widening the gap between the rich and the poor, rendering many people extraordinarily poor, and destroying Earth's life support systems. And we're so intimately woven into this that I consider us not only perpetrators of economic violence, but in bondage to, captive to these ways of life. Most of us are probably wearing articles of clothing made in sweatshops. Most of us probably buy strawberries and snow peas and broccoli and other thing grown on lands that should be feeding their own people, not giving us luxury foods. Every aspect of our economic lives is wound up in ways of being that exploit both Earth and others. So how do we reconcile this? How do we accept that we are created to love neighbor, and on the other hand, we live lives that exploit neighbor and exploit the very Earth on which we live? The statements I've made, the presuppositions I've made, that our way of living economically is not loving, but is rather exploitative and is death-dealing, is a very a loaded assertion, clearly. And we can't spend hours and hours now justifying or arguing that assertion. So I would like to make that argument by means of a few voices from other people, particularly people in the third world or representing people in the third world. So if you would take just a few moments to hear the voices of some other people who claim that our way of economic life is death dealing. The first is simply a strawberry picker, and this is a signature voice in my life right now. It's a strawberry picker who I met while leading a group of church people to Mexico. And the woman looked at me and said, "Our children die, you know, because this land is growing strawberries for your tables rather than growing food for our children." A statement like that, you can imagine, is shattering and scary and pushes. The second voice is the voice of Bishop, or former Bishop, Bernardino Mandlate of Mozambique, a Methodist bishop with whom I worked on a project with the World Council of Churches. And he is speaking about the economic life of the North Atlantic, Europe and North America. And he writes, "What I want has replaced what I need. What I want is a list which increases due to market forces. I am prepared to sacrifice millions around the world to ensure that I live with what I want. Africans suffer and starve so that the living standards in the global north can be maintained and improved. Millions of African children die of malnutrition to ensure that children of the north can overeat." Again, it's a startling statement. And before I go on, I want to say one thing very clearly. I think it's useless to wallow in this kind of reality. And our intent here is not to hammer it home and wallow in it. I simply want to make the point of the enormous problems with our economic way of life, and then move on from there to explore how we are to forge our way into more just alternatives. So don't think that we're going to stay with these voices, but they're voices that need to be heard. The third is, again, a brief statement from a United Nations report. Interesting. Here we go. It's a 1998 United Nations report. 3/5 of the people in developing countries have no access to basic sanitation. Almost 1/3 are without safe drinking water. Installation of water and sanitation for all would cost $9 billion. $11 billion is spent annually on ice cream in Europe. $8 billion is spent annually for cosmetics in the U.S. alone. Basic health care and nutrition for all would cost $13 billion. $17 billion a year is spent on pet food in Europe and the United States. So that's enough. We could go on forever. That's enough to make a point. In contrast to that, I'd like you to hear a few sentences from Martin Luther about the purpose of the Christian life, including economic life. For Martin Luther, the Christian way of living is very much inclusive of how we live economically. He writes, and hold this in contrast to Bishop Mandlaté and the others, a Christian is conscious of nothing else than that the goods which are his are also given to his neighbor. The Christian should be guided in all works by this thought and contemplate this one thing alone, that she or he may serve and benefit others in all that he or she does, considering nothing except the need and advantage of the neighbor, each caring for and working for the other. This is the truly Christian life. So here we see a contrast between that to which we are called, and I would argue for which we are empowered, living in ways that actively love the other, and the ways in which we actually live. The threat, however, is not only to the poor. The threat is also to the earth. The costs of economic globalization, as we know them now, are staggering if we think about the ongoing and future costs to the earth. And here I read a couple of brief statements. First, we now consume in 1 year what it took the earth 1 million years to store up. Much of our glorious productivity is fed by the gigantic throughput of fossil energy. On the one side, the earth is being excavated and permanently scarred, while on the other, a continuous rain of harmful substances drizzles down or filters into the atmosphere. If all the countries followed successfully the industrial example, 5 or 6 planets would be needed to serve as mines and waste dumps. Unquote. Now, the aim of the current model of globalization is for all people to follow the industrialized economic model that will take 6 planet Earths to serve as dump sites and resource mines. The second quote is this. While human, and this is from Paul Hawkins, who writes in a book called The Ecology of Commerce. Hawkins is a successful businessman. While human life depends upon the planet's life's systems, nearly every natural system on the planet is disintegrating, and the human species is the cause of it. Daniel McGuire, a Christian ethicist, writes, "If things continue as they are, we will not. We are an endangered species. Reversing this trend calls for a restructuring of the global economy." So with that, with those voices in the back of our minds, I would just suggest that something is terribly wrong if we go along with life in this mode. Our intent, or my intent for us in the hours we'll spend together this week, is for us to really explore some of the ingredients that make up this way of life, and then explore some of the ingredients that keep us in bondage to it, and finally, some of the sources of power to go otherwise. Now, the subject can be approached from many, many different ways. I am a Christian ethicist, a theological ethicist, and therefore there are certain kinds of questions that I ask. And I'd like to throw out for you as a beginning point a kind of framework of questions to ask as we in our church communities and outside of our church communities go on with exploring how to get out of this mess. I see five sort of sets of questions. The first of them is what I call descriptive questions. They're listed up here. By descriptive, I mean what is going on. That means becoming economically literate, getting a way to analyze, to demystify the dynamics and the power structures that are in play here. And by demystify, to a certain extent, I mean putting a critical eye on what is already assumed to be the way life is. Rather than assuming that things have to go on as they are, putting a critical eye to that and saying who's benefiting and who is suffering and why. Describing what's going on. Now, one of my operating principles is that economics is understandable to everyone. That economics is not for economists, it's not for academicians. Economics is a fundamental literacy, a language that anyone interested in faithful living, public citizenship, should acquire. So that's an operating principle that I thoroughly believe. Second questions are normative, meaning what ought be going on? What does our faith say ought be the purpose of economic life? Why do we buy and sell and invest and use different products? According to Martin Luther, the purpose of our economic activity is to meet our needs and to serve the needs of the needy. That's the purpose of economic activity. But we need to ask, do we need to rethink the purpose of economic activity? At this point, the purpose of economic activity, according to neoclassical economic theory, is creating wealth so that it can trickle down to everyone. And we'll look later on about the validity of the claim that that even happens. The third set of questions is evaluative. How does this, what is going on, measure up against what ought to be going on? The fourth set of questions is perhaps more fun, constructive questions. What are the alternatives? And another of my operating principles is that there are incredibly rich, sophisticated, and easily understood alternatives out there on the table. There are people the globe over, including right here in Washington State, and probably right here in this room, in fact, definitely right here in this room, who are thinking about and living into alternative ways of economic life. Not only in terms of lifestyle, but also in public policy, institutions, ways of farming, ways of doing trade. So what are the alternatives? Now, these obviously are questions that we spend a lifetime answering, but I'm trying to set up a framework of questions by which to approach this burning dilemma. The fifth set of questions is really the ones that we'll be looking at in these hours together. I call them transformative questions, and they are two. What stops us from living into economic justice, and where do we find the moral power to do so? Let me say those questions in slightly broader terms so that they flesh themselves out a little bit. The first is this. If the prevailing model of globalization brutalizes the poor and jeopardizes Earth's regenerative capacities, why do we acquiesce? Why do we acquiesce to that model without standing up and saying, this is an affront to our faith in Jesus Christ? That's question one. Question two, where in our Christian faith traditions are we offered hope and the moral spiritual power to resist, to revision and to rebuild alternative ways that nurture communities and the earth community according to justice and compassion for generations to come? When I say we're in our Christian faith traditions, I identify that because that's where we sit. But it is my firm conviction that in the face of this crisis, all of earth's great faith traditions will need to resource, will need to be drawn upon, will need to be drunk from in order for humanity to find its way out of the pit that we've put ourselves in. So this is a set of questions to pursue as the days and the years go on. And these are the two of those that we'll pursue in these hours together. I see the pursuit of these questions as a kind of journey, and I see it as an ancient journey that involves ancient people in our ancestry, and also an uncharted journey. In other words, we need to go someplace we've never gone before as a species. We need to go someplace that enables us to live in a sustainable relationship with the rest of the earth. In other words, the relationship between the human species and the earth in the last 50 years has become unsustainable. So we need to forge an unforged path. And I call it an ancient journey because it also means drawing upon the wisdom of the past. We are the first human beings, probably 20th century North Atlantic human beings are the first ones in general, I would say, who have ever lived that have not really drawn upon the wisdom of the past in significant ways, but have, in a sense, discarded that. So we have wisdoms, spiritual wisdoms, to draw upon, as well as other forms of wisdom. Forms of agriculture, we saw in the movie the other night, we saw ancient forms of agriculture that were thoroughly sustainable that have been discarded in modern life. So that's where we're going to be going. I'd like to tell you that my pursuit of these questions is really born of despair. I think I have lived in despair about ever being a part of a human community that lived toward economic justice and towards ecological justice. And I think that despair is a very easy response to the voice of the strawberry picker and the bishop we just heard and the UN report and the report about the destruction of the earth. And I would simply say that our hope is born of promises, the promise of the resurrection, and our hope is born of the courage that we can see in communities all over the world, including perhaps our own lives, and our hope is born of wisdom to be tapped in our faith tradition. If it offers anything, it offers hope in the face of the impossible, and that's where we are. I had a couple of hunches when I began pursuing this in academic life, and one of those hunches was that the crisis of economic globalization is a spiritual crisis, and I hold it up as that, a material and spiritual crisis. And secondly, I had a hunch that if we held our economic life in one breath with the conviction that the God of unquenchable love, and biblically, love includes justice, lives in us, we could forge some paths forward. If we hold the economic tragedy and brutality in light of the fact that God lives in our bodies, and this God loves in an unstoppable way, unstopped by death and torture, then we can perhaps forge some paths. I learned as I went along that this God doesn't only live in us, but lives in all of this. And that is even more shimmering and startling and amazing and invites even deeper reflection on what it means to be children of that God. With those things said as an introduction to the week, I'd like to move on. And I have to say this defies every instinct I have about teaching. It would be much better to stop here and spend some time pursuing the things that we've already said. But if we do that, we're never going to get on to the next bit. So I think we'll move on and then leave time at the end for questions. Unless there are some burning clarifying questions right now. Okay. What I'd like to do is what we could call globalization introduction. And the way in which we'll do that is to look at first the five, what I call the five defining trends of globalization as we know it today. Secondly, the economic argument underlying globalization as we know it today. And third and fourth, if we have time, some additional look at the threats it poses and ways in which it contradicts capitalist economic theory. In terms of the five trends, I would suggest that a thorough redesign of the global economy is underway. It is generally referred to as economic globalization, and it impacts not only economic life, but every dimension of life, social life, psychological, all parts of our lives are impacted by this. To understand the complex dynamics and players involved in globalization is mind-boggling. So it seems to me that if we look at a window, we need to find a window through which to peer in order to understand the whole, but put some kind of understandable boundaries around it. And the window that I think is useful is the window of free trade and investment. I put that in quotation marks. Free trade and investment is the... Free trade and investment means the deregulation, the taking away of regulatory mechanisms on international trade and investment so that it can be maximized. It's a movement that is fundamental to all of the international monetary institutions in the world today. Free trade and investment, let me see what else I should say in short order. I will refer to the current model of globalization as neoliberal, which is the term that is used in Africa and Europe and South America. Also, I refer to it as corporate and finance driven. Many people refer to globalization as corporate driven, meaning that decisions are being made by corporations, but I think that's false. It's large global corporations and finance institutions, Wall Street institutions, the bottom line, what will make the most profit, that is also driving this form of globalization. Let's look at five trends that constitute the current model of globalization. One of these trends, and it's the most forthright to understand, the first here is a rapid increase in the movement of goods and services and capital across international borders. Is that fairly self-explanatory? More and more goods and services are being bought and sold across international borders. I say across borders, not between countries, because countries aren't usually the buyers and sellers. It's companies that buy and sell across international borders. The second is less forthright, and I refer to it as the subordination of democratic political power to unaccountable economic power. By that, I mean that the move to free trade and investment from regulations is really a move to disable the capacity of governments, national, local, state, provincial, regional, governmental bodies from making laws and regulations regarding the working of corporations and finance institutions in their lands. In other words, Seattle, King County, Washington State, the USA is being increasingly limited in their power to make rules that govern the functioning of large global businesses in our lands. That's what I mean by this, and we'll come back to that. The third defining trend is that a growing portion of the world's largest economies are centrally planned and directed and unaccountable to the public as a whole. That is, an increasing portion of the world's economies are corporations. In fact, 51 of the 100 largest economies in the world are corporations. Exxon, for instance, has a bigger economy than many nations of the world. GE has a bigger economy than many of the nations of the world. Now, we all know that decisions about economic life are very important public decisions, public policy decisions. If 51 of the largest economies on the face of the earth are corporations, those are not accountable to public decision-making. Those decisions are made by very centralized groups of managers. So we have to wonder, what does that say about democracy? Is democracy growing worldwide as we are being told it is? Or is democracy being threatened worldwide if fundamental decisions about the use of resources are being made not by public entities but by corporate entities? The fourth defining trend is the privatization of goods and services. What that means is that public goods and services increasingly are being brought under private ownership. Perhaps that one is easiest to speak of with examples. Can anyone name examples of that in this country or abroad? Privatization. Are you aware of movements towards privatization in the United States? Think perhaps about prisons increasingly being owned by private companies. Schools, increasing movement towards schools. Healthcare is certainly fairly private in the United States. I think an example of this on a global level would be water. Water, many people think, will be the world's new oil. Take the place of oil, or a place like oil, in terms of being a highly precious item over which wars are fought and which is bought and sold. In fact, water is being privatized in many places. One example is Cochabamba, a city in South America. A European company, I think it was a British company, bought the water supply within 300 miles of Cochabamba, the area surrounding Cochabamba, raised water prices by 300%. Does anyone here have experience in the third world? In poor nations, water means life. If you have access to clean water, you have access to life. And if you don't, you don't. For water prices to go up 300% means that many, many people don't have water. My experience in 2 years taught me that to not have clean water meant that your babies were at great risk of dying because you can't live without clean water. So that's just one example. There were riots around Cochabamba. There was great resistance to this. Another example would be, and this is an example also of number two, the limiting possibilities for governments to regulate corporate activity. A Canadian-based company is purchasing a water supply in Alaska, and it will be shipped to China for packaging or for bottling, and then sold elsewhere around the globe. Now, if water goes for sale, if water is on the market, water is available to people who can pay for it and not to people who can't. That's an example of what I mean by privatization of public goods. Just one example. I'd like to also move back up here for a minute to the second one, what I call the subordination of democratic political power to unaccountable economic power. An example of that would be this, because I think sometimes things are easy to remember by example. Under an existing trade agreement between the United States, Mexico, and Canada, the Exxon Corporation sued Canada for establishing a rule that banned the movement of a toxic substance produced by Exxon across the Canadian lands. In other words, Exxon produces a substance that Canada calls toxic, and Canada bans its movement across Canada. But Exxon says you may not make that rule. It contradicts this international trade agreement, and we will sue you. Canada sued, Exxon sued Canada and won the suit, although won much less money than they had tried, won about $253 million. And that's an example. Canada's capacity to make a rule to benefit the well-being of its citizens is limited by that trade agreement. That's one of hundreds of examples. But I give you that one just to put some flesh on what I'm saying there. The fifth of these five defining trends is the commodification of money. And by the commodification of money, I mean that money has become, to a large extent, a commodity for sale for short-term profit. According to analysts from the right and the left politically, increasing portions of the money that of economic transactions worldwide is money that's being bought and sold. In other words, speculation, currency and investment speculation. Now, it sounds like just an economic fact, like what big deal? But when money is bought and when vast amounts of money are bought and sold for short-term profit, money goes into and is withdrawn from national economies like that. At the drop of a pin, by people unaccountable for the results of that. And what we've seen as a result of that kind of dynamic is what happened in Southeast Asia. Money went in quickly and a big bubble economy formed. Things were built, investments made, and then when it looked like that was risky, money was pulled out and the economies fell to the ground. People were unemployed, people were hungry. And in that particular culture, the shame attached with that was so great that it led to not only death by poverty, but death by shame. A colleague of mine, a Korean theologian, wrote startlingly, and I should have brought it along, about the familial suicides that happened when the economy in Southeast Asia fell because of the shame attached to tremendous poverty. So what I'm saying is that we can't just think this is a little bit up in the air economic fact that speculative investment is such a big part of economic activity. It's a dangerous and I would say immoral reality. Now, these trends, these five kind of dynamics that define economic globalization today come together, I think, in free trade and investment. You see, they all relate to enabling the unregulated trade of money and of goods and of services, once public goods and services, increasingly private, across borders in order to make money. Let me stop and take any questions about what I've said before we go on. Does that seem sort of clear? Does it seem befuddling? Does it seem wrong? misunderstood?
I'm looking forward to hearing you go ahead to the emphasis on hope, because when I hear this, I get very depressed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's actually a very helpful comment.
How long are you here for?
Right. It is a helpful comment because it's my biggest fear. It is depressing. It's horribly depressing. I mean, what can we do is what we can think. Sometimes knowing things is much worse than not knowing things. But why do we have brains? Why do we have hearts? It's certainly not to bury our heads in the sand. And although we could, I mean, we could choose to run from any of this knowledge. It's a very tempting choice, quite frankly. But I'm not rhetorical when I say that if we stick with it, and if we also probe the ideas that are being posed as alternatives, we will never lose hope. And I've learned that, quite frankly, from Africans and Latin Americans who refuse to give up hope and to keep pursuing alternatives on all fronts.
Cindy?
Yes.
I find it very helpful mm-hmm. to hear you verbalize all this, because I think a lot of us mm-hmm. feel things that are going on that we don't like and that mm-hmm. we know are wrong, mm-hmm. but haven't had taken the time to study or put into a logical formation or a communicating way mm-hmm. those ideas. Mm-hmm. And it is depressing, mm-hmm. but it's hopeful for me that other people see it mm-hmm. and have spent the time studying it, which mm-hmm. I will never do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in that alone, there's hope for me. Mm-hmm. And to hear you saying that there is a hopeful side that we'll get to mm-hmm. is enough.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. It would not take all of us long to decide we're going to get a grip on this and get a grip on what's going on and what are alternatives. We did the same subject matter last week, and there are so many different approaches to take to it and look at it. This week we'll be looking at some different approaches. But yeah, let's go on by holding the fact that we could all fall into pits of despair over this and bury our heads. And then let's simply say we won't. And I think one of the reasons it is despair-producing is that probably underneath it all, we acknowledge that a new way is not a mild revision in the course that we're following. A different way is a radical revision in the course that we're following. It means... And I'm not saying radical, meaning I'm not talking about radical, you know, whatever connotations you have in that. I mean radical at the root. We have root core changes to make. And who wants to do that? Who wants to even imagine that life needs to be uprooted and we need to chart unknown paths? I don't particularly want to do that. One thing I know is that it cannot be done by individuals alone. It will be done by us in community. There's no way that we are individual beings with this capacity. We are only people in community with this capacity.
I was just wondering, it seems like 2, 3, 4, 5 mm-hmm. are all negative. Mm-hmm. But there's like number one mm-hmm. is just a fact.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
It's not, you know, that's the way it is.
Yes.
And maybe there's hope in the fact that we internationally can work together, you know, or something like that.
Okay, that's an excellent comment. There is tremendous hope in that we can work across borders, that we can have brothers and sisters in different parts of the world, and we must. In fact, let me elaborate on that a minute. I am now firmly convinced that the knowledge we need to rechart the course will depend upon the extent to which we can hear the ideas and the wisdom coming from people who are on what I call the underside of globalization. We need to hear what people in the two-thirds world and very poor people here are saying, and we will find profound knowledge. So what you talked about, internationalization, is a very important element of our hope. The flip side of what you, or not the flip side, an attached thing, and you pointed to number one as just a fact. The fact of a rapid increase in goods and services across borders is not necessarily neutral, because there are tremendous dangers just in that. The movie we saw the other night pointed out that the average tablespoon of food that the U.S. citizen eats travels 1,000 miles. Now, what does it cost our environment in terms of greenhouse gases to use the fossil fuel to bring our corn 1,000 miles? So the part of the answer might be that instead of maximizing trade, we develop bioregional production of agriculture and other things, and then trade what is necessary to trade rather than maximizing trade. So even number one up there is a negative to some extent. What I think we should do, we have enough time to take in one more piece of subject matter, and then we'll talk more in depth. The subject matter that I would like to take up is the theory that undergirds this. Because any time you stand up to someone who thoroughly believes in corporate and finance-driven globalization and say, I'm sorry, I think it is endangering people who are poor, or threatens people who are very poor, or widens the gap between the rich and the poor, the theory is this. They'll tell you you're wrong. They'll say, freedom of trade and investment from regulation creates wealth. Wealth trickles down to benefit everyone. That is, choices freely made by individuals to buy and sell in the competitive and self-regulated market will result in growth, economic growth, which translates to the greatest good for all. supporters of globalization on all levels basically hold up that theory in very sophisticated forms. They say that in, it takes a whole book to say it, but that is the fundamental underlying theory. So it behooves us to understand that theory to some extent, and we don't really have time to do it very well, but I'm going to say in succinct form that it is true that increasing or deregulating trade and investment does make for growth. Economies grow when they take away regulatory mechanisms on trade and investment. The problem is growth does not necessarily benefit human beings or the earth. And there are many reasons for which growth can be dangerous. One of those is that growth does not take into consideration, does not discriminate between growth that is useful and growth that is destructive. For instance, if you are a mining company in the Philippines and you gut a mountain, taking out the minerals, so that a couple years later that whole land is unsustainable for human life, and the tribes that live there cannot continue to survive, that is economic growth. There's no one that grows our economy more than... And growth counts as a positive things that are actually destructive of families and communities, or family breakdown or health breakdown constitutes as growth. To be a person with a major disease, say a cancer patient, is to contribute to the growing economy. To be involved in a major divorce that's hotly contested, to buy 3 luxury cars and drive them every place you go, buying as much gas and using it as you can, is to contribute to growth. So you see, growth is rather ambiguous. Many things that grow the economy actually represent tremendous human pain, a divorce, a cancer patient, or tremendous destruction. The more we consume, the more we grow the economy. The more junk food and violent video games that we buy, the more processed food and wrappers that we buy and dispense of and buy more, the more we grow the economy. So you see that particular problem with growth equals benefit. There are other problems with the notion that growth is good. One of them has to do with the fact that growth theory does not recognize the limits of the planet. There's a fundamental axiom, a principle of neoclassical economic theory, and that is that growth has no limits. Now, in contrast to that, we now know, and major scientists the world over, 160 of the major scientists who were winners of Nobel Prizes in science wrote a statement saying that we have now come in a collision course with the limitations of our planet. And to keep growing, as this other quote said, will require 6 planets to give us the resources and to be our waste dump. So that's a second problem, the limits to the planet. A third problem with this theory, and I'm only saying these things not to be theoretical, I'm only saying them because if we want to talk about the poverty and the environmental destruction in this model of globalization, we have to be able to refute this notion that, don't worry about it, we're growing economies, we're growing Ireland, we're growing New Zealand, we're growing economies, and it will trickle down. Listen to this. Growth is measured to some extent by GDP, gross domestic product. It used to be measured by GNP, gross national product. People thought it was a rhetorical shift. It happened within the last 10 years, but it was a very significant shift from using GNP to GDP. And it has to do with enabling it to look good, that corporate activity has free rein in other lands. If a corporation, a global corporation, and I'm going to make a parenthesis right here, when I say corporation, I am really meaning mega corporations, global entities. There are many levels of business, and there's a great difference between small business and the 51 of the largest 100 economies on Earth. So we're talking about global corporations. If a company, say, GE, goes into a small Central American nation, or let's say not GE, what's a clothing producing company? Well, let's just say GE. GE goes into Guatemala and builds a factory and produces a lot of stuff and makes a lot of money in Guatemala. And then takes all the money out of Guatemala, most of the money out, repatriates it to the U.S. That amount of money that was made, say $5 million, registers as growth for Guatemala under GDP. Under the GNP, that money that came out registered as growth for the U.S. because that's where the company was based. Under GDP, using GDP, that measures as growth for Guatemala. So we can say, aha, GE is in Guatemala and the economy is growing, even if every red cent is repatriated to the United States. Shake your head if that wasn't clear. Okay, so it was clear. So that is another of the reasons why this theory, free trade and investment, makes for growth. Growth trickles down to benefit all. That's another of the fallacies in that theory, and it's one of the fallacies that we need to be aware of. The final fallacy is that growth is usually measured by, when growth is measured by wealth, it's measured by averages. So for instance, if you measure wealth and income, it's wealth, net wealth in the United States, the average wealth of a citizen is $176,000. This was 1998. And it was up a great deal from 20 years before, up like 22%. However, so that sounds like the U.S. economy is growing, 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 growing. Now in the back of our minds, we know that there are a lot of people on the streets. Increasing numbers of people can't buy health care. Public education is in bad straits. If the economy is growing, why are these things happening? Part of the reason is our measurement of growth. At the same time that the average wealth was $176,000, the median wealth was $17,800. Median means the middle point, where half the people are above it and half the people are under it. That figure was down from 20 years before. So you see, we can claim growth based upon an increasing average, whereas in reality, people are getting poorer. And this is simply because if you have 10 people and one of them becomes a billionaire and the other nine get a bit poorer, the average still goes up. So that is simply my version of, and a very simple version of, why we must be suspect of the fundamental theory that people use to justify free trade and investment.
Can I ask one question?
Of course.
Just real quick, is when you talk about these global corporations,
yes,
are the majority of them American, United States?
No, I can't give you exact figures, but There are global corporations based in many countries, mostly in the industrialized nations. And for some companies, it's no longer clear where they're based because corporate configuration is so complex. One corporation owns various subsidiaries, and where that subsidiary invests is here and here. So there are corporations for which it's almost hard to define a host country. But the U.S. is not the only host company of the largest global corporations. Data on that is easily available, and one of the good sources of that data is the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. I can't give you the phone number, but a quick look on the internet or calling information would give you that information. And the two people that work on corporate issues are, if you want to write them down, John Cavanaugh and Sarah Anderson. So if you wanted to get basic material on that kind of question, or on the figure of 51 of the largest 100, you could contact them. That's a good question, though. Other questions? Ron.
Putting aside some of the negative environmental impact of industrialization around the world,
yes.
One of the arguments I hear around the growth issue, mm-hmm. or a benefit to other smaller nations, is that by these industries going to those nations, it employs people who otherwise would be unemployed. How do you respond to that?
I respond, many things aren't all one way or another. So my instant response is to refute that totally. But it's not completely false. Many people get jobs. And then you need to look at what is the long-term impact of this? If a corporation goes in and builds a factory and people get employed for 10 years, but then, say it's Nike, finds out that they can make shoes a lot cheaper rather than being in this country, but being over here in this country, then Nike pulls out like that, builds its factory in this country, and what happens here? These people that the presence of Nike in this country has displaced other small domestic businesses that were in that country. It has created a gap between the rich and the poor. Many people have gotten richer because Nike is there and others are poorer. So in the short term, Nike being there would be a benefit for those people who get employed. In the long term, it might be devastating once Nike rips itself out of that country. So that's one of my responses. What I hear from colleagues, South African colleagues, is that growth, including, and they're not saying don't invest. Not many people that I hear from two-thirds world countries analyzing this are saying don't invest. They're saying only invest in certain ways. And those ways need to be creating growth that is pro-poor. In other words, the poor of the country benefit most. Everyone can benefit, but the poor benefit most. Pro-environment. The environment can't suffer. Now, if a factory goes into the country, and I'm not talking about Nike now because I don't know about the environmental impact of Nike. What if a factory goes in and creates employment for a certain number of people and thoroughly pollutes the terrain so that a few people are employed, but many, many people's lives are endangered by pollution? I mentioned, and of course, the free trade zones in many countries are an example of that. Countries go into the border, Mexico, the northern part of, companies go into the northern part of Mexico and build factories and employ people, da 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 da. And the toxic wastes that are released are so dangerous, and I am not exaggerating, that there is documentation of babies born to workers without brains because of the toxic nature of the women. The pregnant women working, not the toxic nature of the women, the toxins that the women are exposed to. I went to the free trade zone in Mexico when I was pregnant with my second child, leading a delegation, and the delegation had to go in without me because the physicians that were advising the process said that a pregnant woman couldn't even go in for a day. So I guess another question would be, when someone says, well, an industry is going to go in and create jobs, is what's going to happen to the not only the long-term employment situation, but the environmental situation. So growth growth that is pro-jobs, pro-poor, and pro-environment are some ways to look at the validity of the claim that growth will serve people.
And how often is that?
Well, how often is that? Right. But is that one of the principles that we can hold up when we think about the future? It's probably not too often. Mark.
How does the World Bank and the monetary exchange with different countries play into the, like, a more of the economic justice?
Well, that's a good question, and it's a huge question. We'd have to have a session on it to do it any justice. I would say that at this point, the International Monetary Fund, the basic policy underlying the International Monetary Fund is the organization that makes requirements for countries that are going to receive international loans. And right now, the basic principle is structural adjustment, which means that economies have to open up to maximize exporting their goods and minimize public expenditures. So at this point, in simple terms, the IMF is requiring cutting expenditures for health, food subsidies, transportation subsidies, fuel subsidies, public spending on jobs, and is opening up the market to free trade and investment. So the IMF is really a part of, is hand in glove with corporate and finance-driven globalization at this point. Now, people are talking about that all over the place. Probably everyone here is aware of the call to reform the IMF. And many people would say that the United Nations has a strong role to play in that.
Would the UN and like our World Council of Churches have any teeth to be able to work with that?
The World Council is working closely with officials at IMF, World Bank, and UN. The World Council of Churches is another excellent source of information on globalization. And I did not bring a bibliography, but you could write to the World Council of Churches. You could call your church headquarters and get the address, or contact them on the internet and say, give me the journals that you have on globalization. Two of the most recent journals by Unit 3 of the World Council of Churches, which is Peace, Justice, and the Integrity of Creation, two of those journals have been on globalization. And to the World Council's credit, a lot of the voices in those journals are indigenous voices and voices from the two-thirds world. And they're very excellent kind of, I was going to say primers on globalization, but they're not just primers, they dig you deep real fast. And they would be very fine study guides for churches to have. We do need to stop, and I would just say that this hour has been a beginning look at trying to put our fingers on what is going on. What we will do in the next five sessions is cover a lot of territory, a lot of this journey in a few steps. Tomorrow we're going to look at one of the ideological principles that I think undergirds our acquiescence. And it has to do with who we believe we are. According to free market theory, we are somebody. And we'll talk about who we are and how that is somewhat insidious, and we act according to that definition of who we are. The next day we're going to talk about an alternative notion of who we are. Who are we according to some of Luther's theology, including his theology that talks about God living in every little leaf, in the fire and the stones and the ropes. If we believe what Luther has to say about God living in us and all creatures and elements, what does that tell us about who we are? And how might that who we are empower us to be differently in the global economy? On the fourth day, we're going to do some real looking at the radical economic ethics that are offered by Martin Luther, and at how we can see them as useful today with a lot of caveats. We can't just take anything that he said and pop it into today right out of its context, because we'll do some rotten things if we do that. But how can we make use of some of his economic theory for today? His economic theology, I would say. And the fifth day, we're going to try to hold all these things together and see where they lead in pushing us towards alternatives. So thank you all for being here, for being part of this discussion, and we'll look forward to going on.